That's James Clay and David Fathead Newman. Imagine having a nickname like that, right? Fathead. And said with all the love in the world. Both on tenor sax and sidemen Wynton Kelly on piano, Sam Jones on bass, and Art Taylor on drums with a nifty little number called Some Kind Mean. It's from their 1960 album, The Sound of the Wide Open Spaces. But this is actually a studio session supervised by Cannonball Adderley. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead. It's been a long and bumpy ride to yesterday's Electoral College vote that officially declared the winners, billionaire businessman Donald Trump as president and Governor Michael R. Spence of Indiana as vice president in the 2016 presidential race. But the end of the race is not putting an end to intense debate and intense dissatisfaction about the process that won them and previous candidates going back to 1787 their victories. The president and vice president, the highest offices in the land, are elected by the Electoral College, as we know, and not directly by popular vote. Setting aside for the moment the many, many issues with regard to their respective campaigns, the question today is it time to abolish or do away with the Electoral College? The merits of their campaigns, this includes the campaigns of Democrats Hillary Clinton, former Secretary of State, as president, running for president, and running as her mate, Tim Kaine, the junior U.S. Senator from Virginia. It stands as record that Trump was 2.8 million votes, popular votes, behind. But nonetheless, won because the electoral vote determined that he carried more electoral votes than was required for winning the nomination. So this is an interesting thing. Where you have the electoral vote based on its particular formula for calculating the winner of a presidential election prevailing once again over the popular vote. And this was a pretty significant popular vote, wouldn't you say? 2.8 million votes more than the person who eventually wins the race. So this is a question. Should the Electoral College be abolished? Is it a more democratic process to have in place or to keep in place the popular vote method, which means the people vote directly for the president and vice president, as opposed to the president and vice president being indirectly voted by this electoral college? What are your thoughts on that? And also related to this, we should talk about, I don't go for, getting all excited in terms of fear about what's to happen. We'll talk about that in greater detail. But you can start today if you wish to discuss that. But more so, I'd like to focus on this question. Is the Electoral College, when you think about it, a more democratic way to conduct elections? Would it yield a more democratic result? There are many people who say, well, the Electoral College was instituted by the wise people. They always talk about the forefathers of the country. being just absolutely infallible and wise to the point of godlike stature. And they came up with this idea of the Electoral College to, as a rationale for creating a more even representation across the country of the people's will. But I don't know. I don't know about that. I think a popular vote seems to be very workable. And I think, especially since we have far more evolved systems, we should kind of keep up with the times. There is, I think, a legitimate argument, and heaven knows, I really don't like the fact that the argument becomes significant principally because of Hillary Clinton's 2.8 million votes. But it does raise a legitimate question. It raises a legitimate question. Should people have the right to choose their leader, which is something that happens all over the world? They don't seem to have a problem with it, that the people directly choose their leader. But we have this continual bifurcation that happens every 4 years. We go through this business with the electoral vote. And sometimes you see, as we did in this election, you see a dramatic difference in the vote. When the people vote, they vote one way. But the Electoral College method is a whole different process altogether. And here we saw, and it was attributed to, of course, a campaign problem, a tactical problem committed by Hillary Clinton's campaign, that whereas they were targeting the popular vote, they didn't quite pay attention to the fact that they should have concentrated also on winning the votes in the states that had the most electoral college votes. So this is a continuing problem, I think. And it's a vexing problem because you do get a sense of unfairness here. Heaven forbid that I'm making the case in defense of Hillary Clinton, but it's really not in defense of Hillary Clinton. We're talking about the process, and which is the more democratic process. I mean, you institute a method in 1787, and it has remained that way with one amendment, I think, in 1804, but it is the way that the country determines the leader. And it hasn't gone through any further amendment since 1804. So we have to ask that question. What are your thoughts about that? And by the way, also, you can chime in about your reactions to yesterday, the finalization, the certification of Donald Trump as the new president of the United States. 888-874-4888 is the number to call. Let's take a look at this question and find out whether you're okay with it. I think it's time that we kind of revisit this idea of this Electoral College, because it just doesn't seem to be a democratic representation of the people's will. And there's no way to amend it or to do anything about it. It's just there. It is just there. At least in the event, let's say, that you have the popular vote prevailing over the electoral vote, or the electoral vote abolished entirely, there are things that people can do to contest the vote. If they, you know, that's what recounts are for, and other kinds of legal actions that they can take. But with the electoral vote, really, there's nothing you can do. Once they get a hold of the issue of determining the president and vice president, they are fully and totally and completely in charge. And there's no way to really do anything about that. you know, people lobbied, as they did, asking some of the electors to change their minds or to switch their votes. We didn't see much of that at all. We had no defections from the Trump electors at all. They remained true to their votes. We saw a couple of defections from other electors. There were Democrats who voted in one case for an independent candidate and others who switched their votes to other candidates as well. But we didn't see very much in the way of a massive move by the electors away from the prescribed process. They stuck true to it for the most part, overwhelmingly, as a matter of fact. So I think we have to take a look at this thing. Why? For me, and this is a reference point specific to me, I'm mindful of history. This whole thing about the Electoral College was born in the crucible of racism in this country. It was born out of the history of slavery and power. The power elite designed this system to maintain power throughout the history of the United States. That was the whole thing here. But part of the creation of the Electoral College, the really important part of it, was about curtailing the power of slaves and of African Americans, presumably, in perpetuity. How was the South, the agrarian South, the seat of the slavocracy? How were they going to hold on to power? This was part of the negotiation after the Civil War about how were they going to divide and manage power, political power. They had to come up with a system, a unified system of voting for the president and vice president of the United States, principally the president they were concerned about. But of course, coming out of a war, a very, very costly war, they did not want to aggravate the situation going into this new phase of life. But they still had the realities of the previous life to deal with, and that had to do with the balancing of power between the agrarian South, which was very powerful, and the industrial North. But mostly, they had to factor in for the future, how is this country going to be governed? Who will have the power and who will be able to control that power? What would be the process? What would be fair so that the South doesn't start arguing again with the North and the North arguing with the South? They came up with this formula, this idea of an electoral college, a kind of superseding body that, because this now will be a national vote, that would oversee the national vote. But here's a problem. They had to come up with a formula that would not deprive the South of its political power. And its political power rested chiefly, in its economic power, rested on this question of slavery. In this newly defined, or this concept as it was at the time, can we really give black people the vote? They didn't want to give people of color the vote at all anyway. But if we had to, because we had to have some kind of power, we have to have them participate in the vote. This was the thinking. But not at a level that their vote will be equal to any white person's vote. We will need their votes, but not having the same clout and power, not being of the same vintage as white people's votes. But we can't afford, on the basis of just this vote, to yield all of our political power to the North. So how do we get this question resolved so that we don't end up again in a civil war over the question of the vote? And that's when they decided, well, if we counted the slaves as a person entitled to one vote, then the South loses. Totally. They didn't want to do it at all. But even if they did, they would have to accord full voting rights to people they never intended to incorporate in this process of the democratic order. So the compromise that they came up with, the slave states came up with a compromise that, for the sake of the vote, if we are to maintain this national identity, because now, after the Civil War, you know, people were Americans now. They were Americans, so the vote was national now. Then they said, for purposes of voting only, we will regard each black person as voting person as 3/5 of a person. That was the compromise. And so that is an integral part of this whole question of the Electoral College. They're not applying the 3/5 law anymore, but in so many ways they have had the same effect by gerrymandering districts, legislatures and the Congress gerrymandering districts, suppressing the vote, all these things that we have seen over the past several years to frustrate the vote to the point of having the net effect of black people essentially back to that idea of their vote being whittled down, the value of their vote being whittled away, or being so strictly regulated as to have that same net effect. So that is an aspect of the Electoral College that I am particularly interested in. I'm going to ask a historian to come in and talk about this aspect of the Electoral College and the vote, and blacks in particular, in the United States. But in modern times, let's say just this past election, we see the need to revisit the question about whether the Electoral College is itself a democratic institution. Is it part of the democratic process? Does it have, in fact, the exact opposite effect of thwarting the democratic process? We cannot ignore, despite the fact that, you know, we have these heavy, heavy feelings about Hillary Clinton, but, you know, that's not what we're discussing. Your individual views about Hillary Clinton are really not what we're taking a look at here. We're taking a look at the institution and the clear anomaly of the fact that we had in this last race a candidate who got 2.8 million votes, the popular vote, okay, but did not get the vote of the Electoral College. And we have to take a look at that. What does that mean for the people? Is this a democratic situation where people should be comfortable with the idea that a person, any candidate, can do so well in terms of popular support, but still lose the election? Your thoughts at 888-874-4888, and you're free to comment on the final certification of yesterday. We still have one more step to go to make everything absolutely official, and that would happen when a Bible is produced and Donald Trump puts his hand on it. Hopefully it will not explode. And then he officially is president of the United States. He's officially, but technically, president of the United States now. But it gets to be fully enacted with that last ceremony to occur on January the 20th. So, my thoughts are that we should be taking a look at this question, because I think it is a very, very important question about how we choose a president of this country, but not by popular vote. And considering the stature of the United States in the world community of nations, considering how much we talk about democracy and people participating in the voting process, considering that this process has gone on unchanged, despite the fact that there are clear indications that it is time to either amend it or abolish it. But to leave it as is itself an undemocratic thing to do. And we should, maybe there's a great argument against it. I don't know. There are people who say, well, it was instituted this way for a reason, and that in fact has to do with democracy, to assure a fair representation and to make sure that it's an ironclad will of the people. But I don't know. I have no idea about that. The other thing that we can talk about, as I said, is, your reaction to the certification of Donald Trump as president of the United States. I don't know that we should be panicking. I'm not one to propose that we panic, but we absolutely should begin. I've been talking about this idea of coming to a reckoning about things, especially the political process. There should be a point of reckoning, each individual, with this process, and to locate yourselves on the political spectrum. What is it that you believe? What do you say is your political credo? And what you are willing to do to defend that? How do you intend to go along with life through this change of Donald Trump as president and any other changes that are to come in the future? It suggests that no matter what the change is or what the changes are, you should have some kind of a political identity of your own. You should be able to decide what you're willing to accept or not accept. You should be able to define your own role in this process, whatever it may be, what your standards are, what you will absolutely not tolerate, and to get some clarity about your own political vision. This is the time. Because as we see, the system I just talked about, what started so long ago, it has remained intact since 1804. This is the importance of systems. It has remained intact since 1804. Of course, society has evolved a lot over that span of time until now, but the system remains absolutely the same. It has not changed. And there's something important that we can derive from that in our own reckoning of things. What's our system? Do we have a system? Some kind of individual roadmap, and a collective one as well, as to what this, the big system, what is the relationship to be between that big system and our system? But we don't seem to have one. We don't seem to have one. So this, too, is a point of reckoning. We should be engaged, fully engaged in that process. What is it that we stand for? And what is it that we would stand against? Just getting some clarity here. So I think we need to spend the time, don't worry about fearing this or fearing that. Just take the position that whatever comes, we are at the very least equal to it. You know, we could weather the storm. We can do that. It would be preferable, however, to be prepared to do that, so that we do our thing in a smart way and not be constantly pushed up against a wall and we have no system of our own, no plan that would help us understand which is the best way to go so that we prevail against the system. I'll take a break right now and come back to your calls at 888-874-4888. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. We're talking about the question, is it time to revisit this electoral college formula for determining who the president of the United States would be? Is it time to consider electing the president by popular vote? That's the first question. And you're free to talk about your reactions to the finalization and certification of the 2016 race with the Electoral College absolutely confirming Donald Trump as the next president of the United States. What are your thoughts? At 888-874-4888. I was imagining that you'd have like a torrent of people saying, I want to be heard on this question. You seem a little reluctant today. I especially brought this question of the Electoral College up because it has great and deep roots in our history. And, of course, that history is racist. That's where it came from, the whole idea of severely limiting participation by certain groups in the United States, specifically African Americans, but not limited to African Americans. And the notion, which is basically emulated by some of the candidates who eventually get elected, they're gray, that not everybody should be trusted to contribute to a democracy. It's not for everybody. You know, we have to have credentials in order to enjoy that privilege. Chris from Lawrence, New York, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Chase.
Hello, good afternoon to you.
Hello to the PRN listeners and staff.
Thank you.
I have a question before my statement, if you don't mind. You just asked a question, I think to the effect of what do we believe in and where do we stand on particular issues and our political identity. Let's say, for instance, you have one, and let's say, and I'm not big on protesting and marching, but let's say you do have a belief something you do believe in or something that you would like to take a stand for, and you wanted to introduce policy and have it heard or have it read or share with others and see if they agree with it. Is that something that you would meet someone that you should maybe connect with someone who has the skills or is that something you can write in plain English, or would you require some legal assistance to even construct such a document? How would you go about creating policy that would change the world into what you want it to look like? You know, why are you protesting? What do you want? Okay, well, how does that look on paper? And what are the guidelines for that? As opposed to just walking in the street screaming, you could be walking in the street with a plan to share with people and a vision for what the world should look like as opposed to what it does look like. So how would someone like myself go about constructing such a thing?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's an either-or proposition. You do need people in the street, and people need to be prepared to hit the streets. Mm-hmm. You also need to have some kind of concept. You have to have a clear idea of what it is you want to achieve. In the struggle for freedom, all things are on the table. You know, you okay. don't want to put it into the context of an either-or decision. Because
okay, so I don't want to say they shouldn't. I'm just saying I don't necessarily. I don't want to sound like I'm telling them
okay.
what to do.
No, I appreciate your point of view. I do. But I'm saying let that decision come from, I'm going to use the word tirelessly, come from your own personal reckoning about what this whole process means to you. I mean, to define, in other words, your own big picture, not just on a case-by-case basis, but beyond the immediate situation of any particular political development, what is your big picture? And to really invest some time in thinking about that, so that by the time you write it down, or by the time you conceptualize certain things, you have a very solid idea about what it is you think would be a better alternative than what is being experienced now. I can't stress enough the need for serious, give yourself the time and space to think.
Mm-hmm.
Give yourself, because you could always correct your mistakes on paper. It's like writing a business plan. You could do 20 versions of it before you're satisfied. But begin the process. Don't expect this to happen tomorrow. But begin training, if you will. You are a leader in training. So take it from that perspective. There's no demand that you solve this in 3 days.
Yeah.
But there is an expectation that by the time you step out in a position of a leader, you have devoted substantial amount of time and study in thinking about the issues and what you believe to be better approaches to solving them.
Okay.
You know, I admire you for this, because this is where serious change begins, not just the knee-jerk reaction to an immediate problem, and there's nothing wrong with that either, but for sustained progress, we need people like you to get down to the business of studying and reading and looking at systems that had already been tried, what worked, what did not work. And by the time you come up with your final plan, whatever it is, it will reflect that you have done some serious homework and that you're contributing something very useful and that would outlast you and the immediate problem that you're addressing, and it would be a point of reference for people in the future. That's how you got to go.
Yes, ma'am.
You see, don't feel that you have to do this tomorrow.
No. I was just looking for some guidance, and because I do, I'm hoping to have more time to devote myself to something other than myself in the near future and my family, and I just want to make sure that I'm going about it in an organized and disciplined way, which is why I was wondering if these policies that we find ourselves being oppressed by, who's writing them? And, what expertise are they bringing to the table other than money and influence? and should those of us who want to change this world, should we also have people like that on our side, and should that be part of our focus? Let's say someone is going to go for a march. Should that group maybe be sitting with an attorney before they leave? If you have an idea about policy, should you be sitting with someone who has, you know, studied political science? Should you be sitting with an attorney? Should you be sitting with an economist? Like, what are some, you know, who should your entourage be in such a situation? I guess is the question I'm looking for, the answer I'm looking for.
Well, I would say it starts with you. It starts with one person. Whoever is coming up with the idea, or whoever is interested in changing a particular thing to something else. It starts with one person. And it seems to me that the first order of business is to kind of conceptualize your idea in a pretty definitive way. And then you look at other ideas that had come before it. Because there's hardly an idea that is completely, completely different from anything that has been tried before. You would see elements of your idea in other places. We're talking about, for example, the Electoral College. Look when that started. In 1787. When 2016.
And I'd like to bring it up. And thank you for giving me so much time. And let me ask you about the Electoral College. Now, from what I understand, the people who are on it are appointed.
No, the Electoral College consists of the 100 members, of the U.S. Senate, the 435 members of the House of Representatives, and Washington, D.C. gets three electoral votes. That's it.
Now, no one on either side is arguing whether or not that is completely in opposition to democracy. There's no politician publicly running or has run who has said to themselves or said to us, maybe this isn't the best idea.
No, I think there might be. There might have been. I don't know off the top of my head right now of any, you know, who might have objected to it. But I think that whether they object or didn't register objection to it, I'm referring to the fact that this was a system. This is why you can't beat systems of any type, including the system that you yourself, Chris, should design.
Yes. Yes.
Your system, but the thing is, once you design it and you've taken into consideration a whole bunch of things, it's not going to be perfect. But then you have a tool, you have something that you can now interest people in discussing or adopting or in some way making use of, because you have systematized your thinking. You can't overestimate the power of systems. That's really what you're talking about. When you say you have policy, it's a system. It's a system. This system that they designed has resisted change for all these years. That too was part of their system, designed to resist any kind of change.
And if you don't mind me asking, what are the attributes of a system that is this difficult to change? If I'm finding it hard to explain.
In the sense that we were talking about, we're using the word system, meaning the method of control, of social, political, economic control. That's a system. But when you stop and think about it, we all operate within systems every day. Your family is a system.
Yeah.
Right? Your family is a system. Do you have a... Are you a father with the children?
Yes, father, three children.
Hello, you have one big old system right in front of you.
Yes, I do. Expensive one.
The family unit is a system. And if you look at it as such, you can see how true it is. You probably are doing things that your grandfather and your great-grandfather and your great-great-grandfather did without you even knowing it. What was their system for acquiring property? If they managed to buy a house or some land or something, they had to go against the system. How did they do that? So they devised their own system. They probably didn't know that they were organizing a system, but your family is a system.
Yeah.
It's a system of a unit of power, an economic unit, and a political unit. Your family is a system.
Definitely.
Your block is a system. Your neighborhood is a system. So we have to continue this idea of creating systems and understanding that we actually are systems. It isn't just a government. We are systems too.
And so I'm looking for some historical reference. Are we, being that we all exist within systems and work within systems, when we encounter one such as this one that is so obviously detrimental to us all, why is it that we don't move in a direction to change it?
Well, I don't know that.
Or even consider.
It is, you have to understand, we are going up against a huge system, which is a conglomeration of several different systems themselves.
Yeah.
One of those systems, as we saw working to peak efficiency in this last election, one of those systems is information in the media that tells us not only about the power of their system, but the powerlessness of us. It conditions us. That's a system.
We have to
see how the big system integrates, say, media into shoring up its system. Because part of what the big system is doing and has to do is to figure out ways to manage those that are targeted to be managed. They're not individually, they're not reporters, and they're not publishers and whatnot. So their system is organized in such a way as to use that other system, the information system, information dissemination system, to control us all. But you can't just say, well, okay, that's just media, or that's just television, or that's radio. No, that's a system.
There's a lot of overlay.
Absolutely. So I think you're on the right track of even thinking about this. This is a phenomenal start. What you now have to do is to reconceptualize yourself and your family as a system and as part of a system. But what is it? What kind of system are you living in? And what would be the importance to that system of the work you intend or you believe you should be doing? Now you're beginning to merge realities here. People who are in desperate need and you having the vision, and you would have engaged in study to find out what's the best way to meet those needs. And that,
definitely,
whatever it is you produce, will be a new system. Look,
thank you, Trace.
Marcus Garvey, just want to leave this with you. Marcus Garvey developed a system. He wasn't the only one. I'm just using him as an example. Developed a system of thought, which was meant to liberate people out of the bondage of self-denial. He had an economic system. He even had a religious or spiritual system.
Mm.
He had a system for politics. He had a system for building a new world. He had a system that created a consciousness of Africans throughout the world. That was Garvey. And he was not a very, very lettered man.
Yeah.
But he created a system which still stands today as a legitimate system. So I congratulate you for thinking about it and for getting ready to do your own system of your own. Thanks so much for calling. David from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Yes, Eutrice, when I first called some time ago, that was the first thing I talked to you about was systems. And I see the importance of them. The thing that is going through my mind right now, if when the ruling class that created the Constitution, they had no love of democracy. They wanted to take over from the king and run things themselves in their interests. And democracy would get in the way. Now, as I see it, we've been talking about the Electoral College and the vote, the whether to change from one to the other. You know, that takes a lot of energy to do that. And I don't see that it would make that much difference. The fact is, whether you have the Electoral College or the national vote determining who's president, the system remains the same. Because the system, you see, the system is one of capitalism, imperialism, world domination, and whether you have one method of determining the presidency or the other, it's the same. So even if you change, the conditions of the people would essentially remain the same, because the people who control the system, the oligarchy that runs the country, control the duopoly that they allow to run for the presidency. We have a duopoly. The point is, with lack of ballot access for most people and most parties, with the gerrymandering that goes on in the present system, and a lack of ballot access for a lot of people, things are remaining the same. So I don't think it's a matter of putting all your energy into worrying about the Electoral College or a natural vote. I don't think that should be the big issue. That should not be what people aim for. It's like going on a sinking ship and sitting on a deck and switching from one deck chair to the other.
Oh, that's a very, very vivid, vivid description there.
Yeah.
It is so true.
That's right. That's
so
right.
I appreciate that, and I don't disagree. I don't disagree with that at all.
Yes, and I've been sending you emails, and I don't know if you got them or not. I've got no response.
I haven't gone to my emails just yet. I'm trying to catch up with old stuff, and I'm practically done with that. So I should get on to my brand new batch within about a day or two.
Right. Don't forget me.
No, I won't. I won't. I won't.
Right. So
thank you so much for your call, and thank you for that very, very brilliant analogy there. Thanks so much. We have time for some other calls. At least one more. Leslie from New York, you're on the air.
Hi, so glad to be with you again.
Thank you.
The Constitution is practically illegitimate, especially when it comes to the Electoral College. When George W. Bush ran the first time, he won a narrow Electoral College vote, and course, Kerry ran against him, and Kerry didn't have the popular vote, but he also lost the Electoral College vote because there were voting irregularities in Ohio, which appeared to be tampered with. But Kerry complained about it, but he didn't dispute it. But later, Barbara Boxer tried to dispute it on the Senate floor with California Representative, I can't think of her name, the California rep Barbara Boxer disputed it with. But anyway, they felt that black voters had been disenfranchised. However, Kerry would not pursue their challenge because he said it looked like he had sour grapes. Now, I think that there's an agreement between Republicans and Democrats that all is fair in love and war and elections. Whoever cheats the best wins the game, period. So then there was Al Gore's election against George W. Bush. When Al Gore won the popular vote, but he lost the electoral vote. And that vote was supposed to go to Electoral College then so they could dispute it. And if Electoral College could not make heads or tails of it, then it's supposed to go to the House of Representatives. Instead, somehow the Supreme Court got hold of it. I don't know whose decision that was, but anyway, Supreme Court is not supposed to have any say in a presidential election according to the Constitution. So they just violate the Constitution all the time and in so many ways that we don't even know about it because apparent to us during presidential elections because everything's out of the open. But so many things about the Constitution, the 13th Amendment, the 3/5 Clause, et cetera, et cetera. So I agree with David from Brooklyn. United States, it's like the Titanic. Not only are they shifting chairs around on the deck or the Titanic.
Not you two with the shifting chairs.
But this Titanic is in a vortex and it's taking the rest of the world with it.
So, to you, is this a non-essential question, an immaterial question, whether the current process of having the president selected specifically through the Electoral College as opposed to a popular vote, it makes no difference to you?
I used to think that the Electoral College was the whole problem. But now that I've gotten some years on me and I've gotten some real out of history, I can see that the vote is stolen and distorted and manipulated in so many ways. The whole process is a waste of time. It's a lie. It's a fraud. It's a farce.
Well, you know, it's funny, but I see it your way, too. I've shared with the audience that it's probably a bit more than 20 years since I voted. And I came to the decision to absent myself from the process while I was in a voting booth. That's where I decided that I will not participate in this fraud. I just will not do it. And I said then that unless there is a compelling reason for me to vote, I'm not participating. I'm not going to vote. Sad to report, since that time until now, there hasn't been for me a compelling reason to vote. So I haven't. It's not that I want to not vote. there's no compelling reason to vote for any number of reasons.
I agree. It took me a long time to come to this conclusion because I'm always thinking people died so that I could vote. They wouldn't be trying so hard to take my vote if it didn't matter. But it's a very extremely elaborate farce, and they have to keep up the game in order to keep the people from rebelling.
So my point of reckoning was about that time, that many years ago. And I just can't wait to find a reason to vote. I haven't found a reason to vote. Not even the election of Barack Obama in 2008. Nope, nothing. Didn't do a thing for me. Did not persuade me to vote. But I thank you so much for contributing, Leslie. I enjoyed your call. Look, we have quite a few people who haven't been able to express themselves, and you know what that means. It means we'll transfer you to tomorrow so that we don't deny you the privilege and the honor for us of listening to your thoughts. And I think we should talk more about these things because it starts the wheels rolling, and that's what we want to happen. We want people to think, start thinking. There's nothing wrong with that, and it should be encouraged at all times. So those of you who didn't get in today, please call back tomorrow, and we will start this process all over again. And I thank you so much for your insightful ideas and for the enthusiasm and the confidence with which you offer them for our consideration and benefit. I can't tell you what a great privilege that is, and what a great honor it is to be in your company, people who have no problem at all sharing the most intimate things about themselves, which is their thoughts. Thanks so much. That brings us to the end of the program today. Stay tuned. What's coming up next? It's The Infectious Myth with David Crow, a very enlightening program. You can reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories, at gmail.com. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.